Little simple research, here it is, on the Cassini side. Magnetosphere, recent discoveries, magnetospheric oxygen. One of the most remarkable discoveries about Saturn's magnetosphere was made before Cassini even reached Saturn by Cassini's ultraviolet imaging spectrograph, or UVIS, capable of observing in the ultraviolet wavelength range. UVIS detected a massive buildup of neutral atomic oxygen while the spacecraft was en route to Saturn. A few months after the initial detection, UVIS data showed a large cloud of escaping oxygen atoms had dissipated just as rapidly as it had appeared. Scientists now suspect the sporadic plume at the south pole of the moon, Enceladus, is that it, is responsible. So there you are. All right, coming up in a moment, John Hoag writes on the subjects of the occult, parapsychology, mysticism, and prophecy. He is considered a world authority on Nostradamus and is the best-selling author of numerous books, including Nostradamus, The Complete Prophecies, and Nostradamus, The New Millennium, The Millennium Book of Prophecy, The Last Pope and Messiahs, The Visions and Prophecies for the Second Coming. His work has brought him international acclaim. He's an old hand on this program. Has been published in 18 languages, sold over 1 million copies worldwide. In addition, he's appeared on over 700 radio and television shows on 3 continents. In a moment, John Hoag. Certainly a world expert on Nostradamus. Ladies and gentlemen, here is John Hoag. John, welcome back to the program.
It's been a while. It's been since July 30th last year that we talked.
That long.
And you were skirting 2 typhoons in Manila.
Yes, indeed. It's just about typhoon season again, actually. How have you been, John?
Well, I have been very busy trying to keep a pace of quickening history and get things out before history catches up.
Yeah, it's happening very quickly. Everything in the world right now is unfolding. When I wrote The Quickening, it was a snail compared to what it's doing now.
Yeah, and it seems that one can be carried by it. I mean, I did something in the last 7 weeks that in all my 30 years of writing I've never done before. I wrote a book of 70,000 words in 7 weeks, and it was a book that I was, some inner insight compelled to have written as fast as possible because I tried to get it out before events took place.
Which book is that?
Well, it's the book that I call Nostradamus, The War with Iran.
Yeah, The War with Iran.
And it is an ebook that's posted on my website and fully illustrated and multimedia aspects to it. And basically, as I was writing this book, on the conscious level, I was thinking, there's just no way this war can happen. It just seems too ludicrous that such an idiotic war could take place. But deep down inside, that thing that I just euphemistically call my oracle, which is that opening in me that does this sort of work over the years, interpreting as well as sometimes making my own predictions.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like you've gone from being a Nostradamus scholar to sort of entering the Nostradamus arena yourself.
Well, it's always been there. It's just more and more kind of, some people come out of the closet, other people come out of the out of the Nostradamian mask. And I think if one is really involved deeply into the work, one does start to make similar predictions because it's a talent that we all have. The other thing that is important, as you were saying the last hour, is to document.
That's right.
What one does. And with my Hoag Prophecy Archives and with every show I've done of those 700 plus shows, I've always had a recording of every show.
That's right. You're lucky, John. Look, in furtherance of something that I think you and I and a lot of this audience darn well knows is true, this whole paranormal, this ability to prognosticate, this ability to know things before they're going to happen, it's real. But the only way we're ever going to nail it down scientifically is to do exactly that. Either write a book, send it off to somebody in a way that can be proven later. We've got to start nailing this down, and that'll stop the laughing.
Yes, because one of the great revolutions that are coming for the human race is something that is so rare in our history, and that is a balance. The revolution of balancing between the irrational and the rational, the subjective and the objective. And right now we seem to either be all listening to one side of our perception or listening to the other side and talking beyond each other. The people who call themselves skeptics and cynics clothing and the people who just blindly believe in anything they're told,
yes,
are two extremes. And in a way, extreme is something we're much more familiar in our history than any other than balance. Balance and harmony is almost an alien concept. And yet the whole thrust of the future takes no profit to see that in our near future, the biggest issue we're dealing with is to find a balance, to find a harmony with our earth, with our climate, with each other. And there seems to be certain forces in this quickening that I would like to coin the phrase as the forces of the old humanity, which is coming to an end because we are now in a new age where a new kind of humanity is about to be born in the next century. And what often happens is the old rarely ever surrenders to the new without a fight.
Well, explain to me what you mean by a new humanity. A new humanity in what way? Well, now we're all familiar with, human emotions, you know, anger, envy, jealousy, happiness, joy. I mean, all of these different human emotions that make us all up. How are they going to change?
Well, they're not going to change, but something is going to awaken that's deeper than all of that. All of those issues in the future will be seen as part of the personality, the ego. That in the future, people, as they become more scientifically involved in studying the paranormal, they're going to discover that there is a being, a consciousness that uses the body-mind structure, but is not of the body-mind structure. It's almost like this. If I was to describe a metaphor for where we are today, the old mankind believes that they are one with their car, which would be the body and the mind. They believe that they're so identified with it because they're trained to be identified with it. In the future, because of the crises that are coming in now and through the next 50, 60 years, are going to be crises that evoke a change of habit or a dropping of habits that have gotten us to a point of destruction.
It's going to take something really big to do that.
Well, yes, and there's several things on the front. One of them being the potential of a widening of the war in the Middle East as far as that goes and how that relates to the center of most of our fossil fuel resources. And there's also the definite quickening of ecological and climatic changes, which as far back as the early 90s in my books, I was saying that the scientists are being too cautious, that what's coming is far sooner than what they project. The 3 to 7 foot rise in the oceans back then they thought would happen in the 2100s, and now it's more looking like the mid-21st century. And now some people are saying perhaps even sooner.
So all those climate model critics were correct?
Well, the climate model critics who, I wouldn't say they were correct, except that they were... it's good that the scientists were cautious and not alarmist, but now what we're seeing is there's these big surprises that are coming into the sequence. I mean, intuitively, people who look into the future could see the thing coming, but could not objectively tie it in with objective reality. But now we're discovering, since the last 10 years, that the tundra, once it warms up, be this huge carbon sink or storage area of some of the most large amounts of methane and CO2 gas, is now venting into the atmosphere and cascading a faster change of climate than anyone expected. And, of course, fortunately with objective science, is that once new data comes in, they can then change their views. And unfortunately for us, we are not even within a 10-year decade grace period anymore. We're now looking at 8 years from now, some scientists are saying, before we see the triggering cascading points where oceans begin to rise, the climate goes out of control. I mean, one of the most important reports from last year was that the great conveyor belt of the ocean currents had stopped for a while in December.
It split and stopped, yes.
Yeah, and this is significant, far more significant than Iraq or Anna Nicole Smith or anything else that seems to focus our attention, because it means the very world that we live in and on is becoming undermined, and we have no other place to go. And this is far more significant than any of the problems we have politically or socially. And you know, just the, for instance, just the simple reality that as many prophecies that I've studied and talked with you since the 1994, we've been bandying back and forth prophecies, many prophecies from all over the cultures and histories of mankind that collectively foresee a rise in the Earth's oceans. And you know, it if you have a rise of even several feet, if you have a rise of 10 feet, that means all the ports are inundated. That means the ships cannot unload their cargoes. That means a complete disruption of the food flow of the world.
All of that, yeah.
Yeah, and just a few feet of ocean rise. And it's just, I think one of the biggest problems that humanity has is that there's nothing, I mean, I've even had this with certain occult groups and psychic organizations that sometimes contact me to bounce things off and about what their findings are from their sources. And one of the things that's come up often is that people are saying, you know, we just don't understand this strange presence, this energy that's going across the world. It doesn't seem, we can't seem to read it right. And then they ask me about it, and I say, well, one of the things I see in this strange feeling, I mean, I'm sure a lot of you out there are feeling it, a certain kind of heaviness or fogginess or an intensity of numbness or foreboding that seems to be growing in the world.
Yes.
I'm sure even 5-6 years ago, you can remember how things used to work better, how just the basic functions of government used to work, how you notice how you try to call and do a basic transaction or things, there seems to be more screw-ups that happen. And things that seem rather odd are just kind of taken as a given when, you know, 10 years ago, if you heard a president say certain things that this current president says, he would be taken in a straitjacket, you know, or other leaders. Or it's just a very strange time.
All right, let's begin with Iran. You believe we're about to go to war with Iran, right?
Yes, and to close that point is that what I was going to say to those people is that that there's a mind plague taking place. And that is and Iran is part of that problem, because there's also a kind of madness that seems to be leading the three major protagonists in the Middle East towards a collision or a war, the leaderships of Israel, of Iran, and the United States. So in this book, Nostradamus, The War with Iran, I try to look at what's underpinning this will to catharsis, and it seems that there's a lot of projections of apocalyptic tradition running in all three groups, and that is leading towards a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And I'm not sure the leaders are completely conscious of that. It's kind of an old habit that's reaching its culmination. And part of that problem is that we have a world that is in the psychosphere, the ecology of the psychic atmosphere, the etheric, probably has too many people on the planet thinking and living unconsciously. That's creating a cascading effect, which is perhaps part of what that strange presence is that we all seem to feel, or that how things are getting sillier and crazier, and we don't really know why. It has something to do with what native seers have been saying that from 1990 and climaxing around 2030, this wave of madness is part of the travail that's going to come over the world and start what is called the Great Purification, where a lot of the old ideas will have to be surrendered to the past, and people will have to embrace new ideas and innovations and new ways of thinking and living and being to create a new humanity, which is more spiritually and physically balanced, which lives by two wings of science rather than a faith-based religion, the science of the objective phenomenon, which we have in our normal science, and the science of self-observation, which is a more meditative religious sense, which is more adept to the age of Aquarius, which we're just entering, which is a more science-based rather than faith-based era.
You're talking about a complete change in humanity, and I'm trying to figure out what really could trigger that.
Well, it's about to start, because we're actually a number of things are going to start happening, and they could happen as soon as right now, because right at this moment, at the 40th anniversary of the Six-Day War, there is a pattern in astrology, which is one of the things that Nostradamus used a lot to plot a course of the future, or at least how future history repeats itself.
How important was astrology in how much of a component in his predictions?
Well, it's very key, because he used it to structure back in the 15th century, in the mid-1550s, when he started writing his History of the Future. He used astrology to interpret the movements and leaders and world, the destinies of nations, because you see, with astrology, you can chart a nation as easily as you can chart an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And it is called mundane astrology or political astrology. And Nostradamus was a master of it. And it's one of the key elements in understanding his prophecies is to master this art in looking and plotting the courses of the future.
Are you beginning to use it yourself?
Yes, and since that has happened, since I've gained more, I believe, more understanding into it, and I think the documentation on my website, hokeprophecy.com, is a testament to it, that the accuracy of my work has increased exponentially, especially since the turn of the millennium, when I started to feel like I could get a handle on how these patterns of repetition are expressed through the language and poetry of the stars. Now, astrology to me is not a science. It is a poetry. And the skill is really dependent on the intuition and sensitivity of the user. One person can use, for instance, a language like English to be Shakespeare, and another person can use the language and sound like an idiot. It's really a question of the soul and the consciousness and sensitivity of the person using it. And over the years, I think one of the keys to understanding prophecy is to understand that it's a mirror image of the past repeated in the future.
The past certainly has a habit of doing that, becoming the future. In other words, we go back and revisit and relive our mistakes. John Hogue is my guest. We're here at the bottom of the hour. So he used a lot of astrology, and the sense I get from John Hogue is that he's moving toward becoming a Nostradamus type himself. We'll be right back. Oh, it is very interesting. In the last several interviews with John Hoag, I've kind of been getting the sense that he was moving from a great student of Nostradamus into the field himself. And it clearly would seem so. And I think he used the word out of the closet. I'm not sure where prophets come from, but I think he's got more than one foot through the door. We'll be right back. So, John, I guess I should be asking what it is that you see.
Well, I think it's always the case that someone who interprets another prophet or prophecy, or someone who even makes their own prophecies and then tries to interpret them, is always it's not the person or the prophecy, it's how the individual who sees them or interprets them sees it. And then if it is documented, then one at the very least will find out what the perception of the person is who's doing it. And if there seems to be a timeline or a sense of certain motions in the future that the interpreter is successful with, then one runs with that. And
well, John, you live in a different day and age than Nostradamus did. You don't have to couch it in quatrains or anything else. You can just come right out and tell us what it is you see, and you're on an international radio program right now, so it's going to be very well documented.
Yes, well, there is the preamble for my preamble. This is what I will say. We will have a war with Iran anytime between now through the summer, and it will most likely happen sooner than later, although certain things could delay it. The decisions are already being made, and the key to war or peace is in the hands of Israel.
Israel?
Yes. And one would hope, as I'm trying to set together in this book, Nostradamus, The War with Iran, is that there are a number of prophecies that Nostradamus recorded that talk about Persia, which is Iran, talks about Mesopotamia, which is Iraq, and also the importance of what happens in a war that lasted 6 days and how it relates to, he mentions those people that were involved in it, and it's a significant thing that we are speaking this very day, 40 years ago, was the sixth and final day of the Six-Day War, which is very significant, more so than the other wars that have been fought in recent times since 1948, because this was the war that defined the messianic issues, kind of let them out of Pandora's box, if you will, to curse us and bring us as well hope that we can find a better solution. What I'm saying here is that when Israel took back the old city and reconquered the Temple Mount and the Wailing Wall, mm-hmm. they also took back, which was not only the foundation of their temple, ancient Jewish temple, which is one of the key steps in prophecy for the final days of the appearance of the Jewish Messiah, but it also triggered messianic passions in Islam, because it was considered the last step. From this fascinating prophecy that I uncovered that was attributed in the Hadith, which is the sayings of Muhammad that were made in the 7th century that are not in the Quran, the holy book of Islam, but are a number of sayings and observations that are actually many more words than the Quran itself that Muhammad had recorded. And in the prophecy, he talked about something that was quite chilling and surprising to me, something I never expected to hear. Basically, he starts the prophecy, to paraphrase it, with talking to a disciple about what the future of Islam would be. And remember, back in the 7th century, there were only a few thousand disciples at the time, mm-hmm. and he was asked what would be the future of Islam, and he basically said, "You will the number of believers will count equal to the foam of the sea."
Wow.
Interesting way of putting it, because right now in our present day there are 1 billion people in the Ummah, which is the community of Islam, Shia, Sunni, and other sects. That transcends the national borders of countries. It's all the people who are the faithful. But he said at that time, they would have discovered tremendous wealth, but certain Christian forces would use that wealth against them, and they would lose their, they would cling, be afraid of dying and cling to life and materialism. But he said that at a certain point, there would be Muslims who would not, they would be often manipulated and used by the Christians to fight their wars, and then the Christians would turn around and say it was all their doing and not these people. They would even take them to the lands of snow-capped mountains and wooded forests to see peace treaties made. It almost sounds like what happened with Lawrence of Arabia in 1917, 1918, when the what would be the first king of Iraq was brought to the Versailles treaties, to Europe, to the land of the snow-capped mountains and the forests, to see the Christian leaders kind of take credit for what they did to overthrow the Ottoman Empire. And then their lands were exploited and their wealth was exploited, just like Muhammad had predicted. But he says that things would turn around when there would be a new jihad, a jihad of the black flags, a sea of black flags that would first appear in Khorasan, which is a term for Greater Persia, which is usually used in ancient geography for Afghanistan. He said from Afghanistan would come the holy warriors. They would first be seen there, and they would then march westward eventually go all the way to Jerusalem. Now, prophecy, especially in the Middle East, is, unlike any other tradition, is very much politicized. All other traditions, it may or may not happen, but if you look at the great prophetic traditions coming from the Middle East, they have one significant tradition they share beyond all other traditions. They are into self-fulfillment. It's kind of the next step, which is the common adage that you hear in the Middle East, is that perception is the truth. And this is also equates into their view of the future.
I think you believe that not only are those you're speaking of in the Middle East into self-fulfillment, you also believe that the Israeli leaders and our leaders here in the U.S. are also into self-fulfillment.
Yes, and the strange irony about this situation with Iran is that a circle is being coming back to full circle. The place where apocalyptic end-time Armageddon battles were first conceived in religious thought, it was not in Judaism, but in ancient Zoroastrianism in the lands of Persia. And there are many Jewish scholars that I've been in contact with that have made me aware of it since 1986 with my first book, that many of the things that are considered Jewish mysticism are actually dispensed from the Persians who liberated the Jews from Babylonia to go back after the captivity to rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild their kingdom. Many things were dispensed from the Persians that became amalgamated with Jewish mysticism. One of the key points was the idea of a final battle between good and evil, which is a Persian idea. And in a strange way, just as we see in industry that America was often the inventor of great ideas in industry that other countries in the East actually adapt better into higher forms, just like it's often been said America invents it, the Japanese perfect it. In the same way, the Persians created the concept of apocalypse and a final battle. Judaism, which is the mother religion of Christianity and Islam, perfected the concept. And now we're seeing a closing of the circle back to the source where Israel and Iran are at a hair's breadth from going to war. Israel has been, Israeli jets have been practicing flights from Tel Aviv or the region of Tel Aviv all the way to Gibraltar and back. It's about around 2,000-mile journey. And they've been training their pilots for a long-distance attack, which may, that's the same distance it would take to go through the Gulf of Aqaba, down the Red Sea, make a circuit towards the east around the Arabian Peninsula, in through the Strait of Hormuz to bomb Iraq, Natanz, and Isfahan, the three major centers of the Iranian nuclear program.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me.
And it's another fascinating thing about this for me is that we have in predictive astrology a Saturn return taking place. Now, to make that in layman's terms, it's like Saturn is the ruler of reality and karma. It's like action, reaction. Israel was born and forged in war. It was in the exact same aspects that we are having now with Saturn and Leo have returned again to the natal position as we speak. And with Mars, the planet that is the god of war in the astrological language, is now trined that Saturn conjunction or that Saturn transit. And what that means in layman's terms is if you look at that through history and the map of time, these aspects almost like clockwork are there when major wars happen.
All right, so John, you see this unfolding beginning with an attack by Israel on the nuclear facilities of Iran. Is that correct?
Yes. It used to be, the plan has been, and there's this prophecy in Nostradamus about a great and terrible war, horrible war would be planned by the West. And there are certainly a number of things, and I go in detail about this in the book, Nostradamus, the War with Iran, that if you take a timeline of all the things that have been uncovered with the Bush administration and Ariel Sharon's administration, Israel, and the plans that have been set forth to prepare their nations for a war with Iran, that, in fact, if you go all the way back to the first neoconservative manifestos of 1992, which were also edited by Paul Wolfowitz and Vice President Dick Cheney, they were already looking at the idea of a regime change in two acts, Iraq and Iran, acts one and two.
Okay, well, you know, I can kind of see that, John. What I don't see is how an Israeli attack on Iran, even with a wink and a nod or more from the U.S., would become transformed into Armageddon. With the current geopolitical situation in the world, how does that happen, John?
Well, let's see. If you kind of, you there are several scenarios that are in the prophecies. One is Iran hits back with its supersonic missiles that would be fired in a very small region that no one has ever seen used before. In the case of, we have the U.S. Navy putting two major supercarrier units, fleets, into an area the size that's smaller than the Adriatic Sea. It is usually a deep water Navy has a 200-mile radius so they can do over-the-horizon counterattacks with its counter-missile system.
Sure.
This is literally going to be thrusts coming up within 60 miles, 70 miles with Yakhonts and other Russian missiles codenamed Sudden Burn and Mosquito that are can ride the water at 9 feet at Mach 2.
Okay.
And the Iranians also have hundreds of Echoset missiles, which just, I think, Argentina during the Falklands War had in 1982 had five in their entire arsenal, of which they sank two major units of the Royal Navy, and they were shot piecemeal. No one knows what will happen when hundreds of them are shot in a tight area of the Persian Gulf, Strait of Hormuz, where it's narrow enough in the Strait of Hormuz for artillery to actually take pot shots at U.S. naval units.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we have here is a repetition of history that reminds me very much of 1914, August 1914. You have a kind of military thinking that is dominating the U.S. Navy that is Cold War in its nature. In theory, no one has ever seen anti-missile ship combat in real warfare conditions. There's never really been in history a Navy system that had to fight off swarms of missiles. And just like no one knew what the machine gun would do in the first stages of 1914 in World War One, some people had theories that it would force everybody to dig in and be in a static front. Other people believed the war would be over by Christmas and it would be some variation of Napoleonic glory. But the problem is that our technology, untested, is now again in the repetition of history before us in a future war. No one really knows what is going to remain theory and what's going to be remain reality. Now, if you have a situation where the U.S. Navy is suddenly overwhelmed by too many targets, and through the attrition of missile attacks, on top of that, supersonic missile attacks, from a fleet of Iranian submarines that the Kilo-class attack submarines that were built by the Russians, there's three of them at least.
Yes.
You could see U.S. carriers like fish in a barrel trying not being able to hit and take down every missile that comes. You also see a situation, another scenario is that Iran doesn't do anything if they're attacked, and they play the martyr. And this becomes the Pearl Harbor. The attack, the air attack on Iran becomes the Pearl Harbor for the Islamic world. And then one out of six people on the planet are against the West. That actually creates the very thing that a lot of people are trying to avoid, a war. As you and I talked before, you once asked me, I think, in the last show we did last year, is this really a war of cultures and religions? Is this a religious world war?
That's right.
And I said back then, yes, that is the danger. That is what's lurking before us. If intemperate minds, guided unconsciously by messianic fevers, move forward in faith rather than fact about what needs to be done. The thing that I find very disturbing is that for the first time in my life, the contacts that I have with the intelligence that's coming to Mossad seems to be the Israeli intelligence, seems to be propagating a war rather than reporting objectively. When you have such a wide variance of beliefs about what Iran can do, some outside of Mossad, they don't believe Iran can even paint watches to glow with radiation, let alone build atomic bombs for another 10 years. But then you get statements being made through Mossad that they are able to build a crude nuclear bomb that they could put into a civilian jet and land in Tel Aviv and cause a great terrorist event. That's a very wide variance of belief in what's happening.
So sure is.
It says to me that there's a lot of passion running here. In fact, I look at the astrology and the predictive political astrology involved, and what I see in that stellar language is people are into their emotions and their intolerance right now because of this bellicose time rather than reason. And that's
right.
When wars start.
All right, John, hold it right there. So John foresees a coming war with Iran to be started by Israel. Entirely possible. Israel certainly wants those nuclear facilities gone, no matter what the stage of development. They want them out of there as they did previously. And one can certainly imagine, can't one, an attack. We'll be right back.